Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. Most weeks here on the show, we take a look at the legal system with Case in Point from our friends at the Marshall Project. And this week's case takes us back to Chicago in 2009.
This is a case that arises out of the gangs of Chicago. You have a young man, 17 at the time of the alleged crime, Djurdjilov, who is accused of essentially helping to set fire to an apartment that ended up resulting in the death of two innocent people. He was questioned over and over again by the police, and in the end you have essentially a conviction that sends him to prison for decades and decades and decades.
That's Andrew Cohen, senior editor at the Marshall Project, and he's talking about the 2014 conviction of Jovan Djurdjilov, who was found guilty of arson and two counts of first-degree murder. Djurdjilov was sentenced to 90 years in prison, but the story doesn't end there.
He appeals and basically makes two arguments, one that his interrogation by the Chicago police in Cook County, that it was coercive to the point where whatever he said should not have been told to jurors, and he says that when he asked for, or when his attorney asked for, money to hire an expert to look at cell phone records, which were critical to the prosecution's case, the judge refused to do that. Turns out it was the cell phone request that ends up giving Djurdjilov a new trial, or at least a chance for a new trial, which is where the case stands today.
Still, it's those 36 hours of on and off interrogation by Chicago police that Andrew says raised some red flags for Case in Point.
During that, you have sort of the textbook good cop, bad cop scenario where he is threatened and cajoled into giving a statement. At one point, and this is why I thought the case was worth mentioning, they essentially threaten him with the death penalty. They say that if he doesn't talk, he is going to get the needle. But he could not ever have been given the death penalty because he was under the age of 18 at the time the crime was committed. And we have noticed that this is a theme in many of these interrogations. Even when someone is categorically precluded from capital punishment, the police threaten it anyway, hoping that it is going to elicit some sort of a statement.
But we should be clear, Djurdjilov confessed to this crime, right?
Well, he made incriminating statements. He made statements that were inconsistent. First, he said one thing about his role in the crime, then he said something else, and then he said a third thing. And of course, prosecutors at the trial were able to say, listen, this is a guy who made inconsistent statements that tend to incriminate him. That and other evidence, some of it very shaky, quite frankly, generates the conviction here. So this is not, as we know it today, a case of a false confession. What we learn from the case, though, is that the cops during these interrogations can really lie about the facts or the evidence either presented to them or not presented to them. They could try to fool a suspect, but then they get into trouble when they make legal pronouncements during an interrogation. And this case is one of those cases that sort of straddles that line.
Well, I want to bring in Clara Stevens here. Clara is a research scholar at the National Registry of Exonerations and an expert on police interrogations. What exactly, Clara, are police allowed to do in an interrogation like that? They're certainly allowed to try to fool the suspect. They're allowed to try to promise them things, I suppose. But Andrew is saying legally, he could have never gotten the needle, as they said. Is that illegal?
Well, the Supreme Court hasn't specifically ruled on that yet. As you can see in most of these Supreme Court cases, the decisions turn on a really specific fact pattern. And this specific issue of threatening a death penalty, whether or not it is legal even, has not been ruled on one way or the other. In our research, we consider that any threat of the death penalty, whether, you know, eventually they could potentially be put to death, is misconduct.
What about other types of manipulations that might take place in interrogation, like walking in from the other room and saying, you know, your friend just flipped on you, he just dropped a dime on you, you better come clean? That may or may not be true, but that's allowed, right?
Yes, that is allowed. Another thing that we often see in false confessions is the use of polygraphs. So a suspect will be polygraphed and the result will be positive, negative, inconclusive, whatever it is, but the officer will lie and say, you failed this polygraph. We know you're lying. Just admit to us that you did this. There are very few restrictions on what an officer can or can't lie about in interrogations like this.
Well, we should make the point that we don't know whether Jovan Dzerzhalov's confession was false or not, and his original conviction was not overturned on that basis. But Clara, what do we know about different police tactics in interrogations and how they can influence confessions that come from suspects?
Well, we broadly classify those into misconduct and non-misconduct. For the misconduct, those would be things like offering a plea bargain. Police officers are not legally allowed to offer a plea bargain. But then there are things that I am personally troubled by, but that are not illegal, and that some in the law enforcement profession would say are important tools to get actually guilty people to admit to what they did, because of course that's never in their interest or hardly ever. So some of the things that they do is they offer promises, things like if you just admit what you did, you can go home, or if you admit what you know, or tell me something I want to know and you can go home. And then another one is feeding details. So officers can tell the suspect exactly what happened in the crime in an effort to get them to parrot it back to them.
So, Andrew Cohen, what does all of this say, Clara's analysis here? What does all of it say about the state of interrogation? Every jurisdiction is different. What can we conclude about Jovan Dzerzhalov's case?
To me, it's a window, this case is, into police tactics. It's a window into reform that has come to some of these rooms where suspects are being grilled about a murder. But it's also a recognition that the courts aren't doing a very good job of making sure that coercion isn't actually what most of us would think of when we think of coercion.
Clara, is there a law in every jurisdiction or every state that confessions of this kind, interrogations, have to be videotaped? Seems like it was very useful in this case. Do the cops have to do it?
No, they do not. In most places, that is not the case. And as Andrew said correctly, that is one of the main policy goals of reformers, because it prevents police from engaging in misconduct, and this helps alleviate some of that. And it also makes it possible for judges and juries to evaluate these confessions realistically and in context. But it's true, in most places, there is no law that you have to record interrogations either by video or by audio.
Clara Stevens is research scholar at the National Registry of Exonerations. Clara, thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And as always, Andrew Cohen, senior editor at the Marshall Project. Thanks, Andrew.
It's my pleasure.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More at Staples stores or staples.com/print and marketing. Staples, it's pro time.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.